Hey, 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 this is Principal Co-host Sam. As some of you may have already heard, this season is the last season of Inner Hole Uprising. But turn that frown upside down and buckle up, because from now until the end of November, you're in store for the last dance, the final hoorah, our swan song, the last act, our farewell appearance, our famous last words, the culmination. And it's gonna be good, and we want you to be a part of it. So if you have special memories or moments of IHU that you'd like to share with us, drop us a line. It'll make us feel all warm and fuzzy inside, and we'll play them on our final episode. To share your thoughts, leave a voicemail to 404-491-9158. Again, that's 404-491-9158. That number will be in the show notes. Thanks for rocking with us for 10 seasons. All right, let's start the show. Welcome to the Inner Hole Uprising, the podcast about sex, love, and dating from the perspective of me, Sam, one black, non-monogamish, non-binary-ish feminist hoe who lives in New York City, whose pronouns are they, them, she, and her. And today I'm joined by...
Rob, the god, one queer, non-binary feminist with a fatty pronouns, they, them, and daddy.
Every episode of the Inner Hole Uprising works like this. Myself and my lovely rotating co-hosts talk about sex, love, and dating as it pertains to current events in the world, our lives, and yours. And occasionally we hit you with interviews with insightful folks or do deep dive episodes on a topic of our choice. Today is one of those insightful, folky episodes, and we're excited to get into it. We're talking all about STIs in the Black American community. Specifically, we're getting into things like stigma, sequential epidemics or syndemics. You're going to learn about what that means, the future of STI treatment in America, what the deal with monkeypox was, and much, much more. And we're joined by a very special guest to do it. But before we get into that, how can they follow along with the conversation, Rob?
If you would like to follow along with the conversation having this podcast on social media, you can do so by using the hashtag Inner Hole Uprising or tweet us at Inner Hole Uprising without the G on Twitter. We're also at Inner Hole Uprising on Instagram and Facebook.
Love it. All right, let's hop right in. So today we're speaking with Dr. Tiffany Velka Dyer, pronouns she, her, hers. And because we got acquainted this morning, we went through a little crucible together. We're calling her TP for the rest of the episode because we got that personal insight. So TP is an epidemiologist and health disparity scholar whose research examines the influence of social, psychological, and behavioral factors on STI and HIV risk in Black populations. Her work examines syndemics, which are intersecting psychosocial and structural barriers, including the impact of trauma, poor mental health, and criminal justice involvement on STI and HIV outcomes for Black sexual and gender minorities, as well as Black women living with HIV in the DC metro area. Welcome, TP.
Yeah.
Welcome, welcome.
Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction.
Thank you for being here with us. Rob, would you like to hop right in with the first question?
Yes, yes, yes. So you've been doing this very important work for over 15 years. How and why did this work come into your life?
That's an excellent question. I appreciate that being asked. I am from Compton, California, born and raised in Compton. Mm-hmm. And as some people may know, so Compton is the suburb of Los Angeles. Nobody ever says that. They just say it's Compton, but it's a suburb of Los Angeles. Pretty middle class. You know, everybody, you know, my parents are from the South, but, you know, migrated to the West Coast, like a lot of people did, fleeing all of the things that were happening here. And I started doing this work I feel like I've always been doing this work, right? So even when I was an undergraduate at UCLA, I was one of the co-chairs of our Black Hypertension Project, our Black Free Health Project, African Student Union. And, but it was after I had my son, because I had my son, you want to talk about an inner hoe. I had my son when I was an undergraduate. I was like, okay. And my mother was like, so clearly you're not only studying. I was like, mm-mm. So I was a young mom. And when I got, okay, so no. So then after I had my son, I remember my dad telling me that he had tested positive for tuberculosis. And I was like, well, it's kind of the 90s. Like that didn't really happen a whole lot. So he was like, well, they're going to test me for HIV just to rule that out. And we were like, all right, whatever, whatever, whatever. The reason I mentioned my son is because my son was born premature and they were going to do a blood transfusion. And my parents were the person that I were going to have to donate the blood. in retrospect, I was like, I'm glad I didn't do that, because this was 1993 before they were really testing the blood and doing the stuff. So my dad's test was positive, and that changed the course of everything for me. So not only was I an early mom, my dad was also diagnosed with HIV. And this was during a time, this was 1990, he was diagnosed in 94. So no telling how long he'd had it. And this was during a time before there was highly active antiretroviral therapies. So HART really hit the scene in about 97, right? That's what the drug cocktails that, you know, people call them. And so I always tell my students, like, when you're doing this kind of work, you have to ask yourself, what is your why? You know, a lot of people just want to tag on to something. They're like, oh, I like the syndemics. That sounds this. I want to do that. But for me, it was my dad. You know, he passed away in 2018 of complications of his HIV. And he was also in his early 80s. So he was getting older. He'd lived with it for like 30 years, right? So it was him. It was him. My uncle is Little Richard, the rock and roll human. He's my dad's brother. So it's also him, right? And his, my uncle's funny. So everybody's like, my uncle's like the original black queer, like human, you know, right? He's the queerest human. His queerness was just so beautiful. And so then he's him. And his showmanship and his just everything. I mean, I grew up with him. And my dad has 11 siblings. My grandmother had 12 kids, one of which was my Uncle Richard. And so him too, right? And so I didn't realize that I was going to get into the work until the HIV part kind of brought me into this space where now I'm focused primarily on LGBTQIA2+ folks. And then also Black cisgender women who are unduly taxed, I'll say, by systems of oppression that meet at the intersection of race, sex, gender identity, sexual orientation, able-bodiedness, differences, and just all of those things. So that's it. My dad, my kid, my uncle, my community, that's kind of what brought me here.
That's a pathway and a trajectory that makes total sense. I mean, why not make your life's work helping your community? I think that that's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that with us. And holy cow, we got a rock star in the room. I didn't know Little Richard was going to make an appearance. Freaking cool. He's
going to find his way up in something.
That's funny. Yeah. That's so funny. And then I guess kind of like peeling a little bit back before all of these things happen, something that I think that we're curious about is, what kind of sex education and information about STIs did you have growing up before these things kind of like came into your life?
Very little. I was talking to my best friend yesterday, and she was kind of like blaming her mom for like not doing things. And I was like, you can't really, you know, as a parent, you know, you do your best, you know. So my mom had 3 kids, and my dad was on tour with my uncle. She was raising the kids, the blah, blah, blah thing, you know. And so it was, in my opinion, she just didn't have, I call it time. You know, I'm the only girl. I have brothers. So in terms of what you get in the home, I think is different from what you get in school. So I was born in 72, and I went to private school. So it wasn't, so they definitely weren't talking about sex, you know, and in like parochial private, like I went to Catholic school. You know what I mean? And so they weren't talking about sex for sure. It was, don't do it. Like literally, I don't even know if anybody said that. Don't do it. I don't think anybody even talked about it at all. It was like nothing. And so that's interesting that you asked that question, because part of my entrance into this field as well was after I graduated from UCLA, I was asked to be a health educator in Inglewood, California. And I was asked to be, so I was the person, they called me the condom lady. So I was 20... or at the time, maybe, had my kid. And I was the person that would go to schools and here's how you prevent yourself from getting pregnant. Even though I had a baby, I was like, maybe I'm not the right person, because I don't know. And then also not get STD, not even sexually transmitted infections, sexually transmitted diseases. So I would go to LA County and Inglewood Unified School District, high schools, and do It was called Reducing the Risk for High School Students. For middle school students, it was an abstinence-only curriculum. And that I had an issue with that a little bit because I went to one sixth grade class and there was a little girl who was missing. I said, she ain't never here. And then somebody's like, well, she just had a baby. This is her second baby. I was like, sixth grade? I was like, you know, so then when you see someone that young who gets pregnant, I was very clear. I was like, okay, she's not just out here. She ain't got no boyfriend and they're having sex and she's pregnant. This is probably someone in, you know, she's been, you know, molested or whatever the word is we want to use for it. If you're, you know, 12, you know what I'm saying? It's probably a family member who's just a touch bit older, you know what I mean? But that's probably what it is. So this is her second baby. And so I was the person that would then go out and do the curricula for high school and middle school students, even though I didn't get that. And I would go and I would show the pictures of the, you know, the vagina and the penis with the warts and all the thing, you know, all the stuff that'd be like, make people go like, I don't think I want that. And, you know, I showed him to my kid. He was like three. I was like, you know, whatever. So he's grew up with the stuff. He was like, can I get away from you? And so I was the person to do that. But in school, I didn't get that. And again, this was pre, you know, so we're talking about the 80s now. So we didn't have no smartphones. You had a telephone at home that connected to the wall with the cord. You couldn't go that far. There was no social media. You read the newspaper. You got the information. You saw it on the news. You got the information. If you didn't do either, you had the Encyclopedia Britannica. But all that was just anatomy and physiology and things like that. So if you didn't get it in school or from your friends, you know, and then that's where you learned it on the bus, you know, riding home from school or whatever. That was your sex education, which was what the homies are saying it is. You know what I'm saying? That was it. It was like, I think this is how it works. So yeah. Especially going to Catholic school, which again might be why as soon as I got out of my mama's house, I was like, let's try this out, you know, kind of thing. And yeah, you know, I had my baby, you know, so I don't, you know, but he's a blessing. Like he's like 55 years old now. So it's, so I don't, you know, so yeah, things turn out the way that they turn out, but it's all like you were saying, like the journey that kind of got me here. And it's weird because all the threads actually do link together. I didn't realize that until someone asked me, can tell me about how you got here. And I'm like, yeah, it actually started with, you know, my kid, you know, and my dad and stuff. So, yeah.
It's amazing. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Yeah.
So to steer towards the work that you do, so what are some of the current statistics on STIs, STDs in the Black community, especially regarding gender minorities, sexual minorities?
Hey, I'm glad you asked that question. So the majority of my work focuses on HIV, but I look at it from a behavioral kind of standpoint of much of what I do. So when you're asking people again about like STIs and things like that, there's that clinical component where you're talking about, you know, what happens in the body when someone is exposed to a pathogen. And then you talk about the behavioral piece. So I'm a social epidemiologist, not clinical. So I think about the social and sort of sociopolitical and structural sort of aspects of what put specific people at greater susceptibility for these outcomes. And a lot of times it's not physical. A lot of times it is social and environmental and this community aspect of things. So first I'm going to talk about Black women. And these are Black women and there's no specification in terms of gender identity or sexual orientation, but just in general for Black women, our diagnosis rates are 14 times that of the rate of white women and 5 times that of Hispanic and Latinas. So for Black women, this is our incidence. So incidence would be the number of new cases that are diagnosed each year. So for the whole United States of America, the incidence of HIV has not decreased. So it's roughly around about 40,000 per year are still contract HIV. It becomes an issue of disparities when you think about the fact that it's not disparate if you make up, for instance, we think about Latinas. If you make up 17% of the population and 18% of new diagnoses, that is not disparate. For white women, if you make up 62% of the population and 22% of diagnoses, that's not disparate. Matter of fact, you that's banging. For Black women, we make up 13% of the population and 55% of new diagnoses. That's a problem, right? And so while rates are going down for everybody, for Black women, it's still the highest when you look at other racial ethnic groups across the board. So let's see, there's about 250 women living with HIV.
That's 250,000 women in the US.
Of those, 57% are Black. And when we think about our death rates, our mortality rates are also 14 times that of white women and 5 times that of Hispanic and Latino women. So it's a problem. And the population I primarily work with, gay and bisexual Black men and men who have sex with men, about 54% of all diagnosed HIV is attributed to that subpopulation of men. This has been on the rise since 2005. Out of all people living with HIV, and these are Maryland statistics, about 41% of all cases are men who have sex with men. And I want to be very clear when I say MSM, because that's a behavioral category. So what we find, because of stigma that's related to identity, orientation, et cetera, what we find is, and just because of the stigma is, and disclosure and things of that nature, that some men don't identify as being gay or bisexual, but behaviorally, they have sex with men. They have sex with other men, but don't identify. So that's why I'm saying MSM. I just want to be very clear about that. As it pertains to, I think the research is really, we're at the baby stages of really, really, really focusing, I think, on sexual and gender minoritized women. I think we skip over cisgender women who are lesbian identified or are bisexually identified. We kind of skip over, and that's a problem, right? And so we go straight to, and then we, you know, here's the thing. We don't talk about women at all. I think that's the thing. I don't know why. I did a whole talk yesterday and I was like, why we're still not talking about Black women. It's gotta be a trick. Like, I'm like, this has to be somewhere. Somebody in the backs of some offices of some building are like rubbing their hands together, like, we just aren't gonna, you know, what about Black women? No, we're not. I don't understand it. I do. I do understand. We have to have an understanding of the historical context of trauma and racism and slavery and all of the things that have been put on the backs of Black women. When you want to think about why we just don't, ain't nobody talking about us. It's like, it's really sad. It's unfortunate.
If I could chime in with like a weird kind of hypothesis, it's like the only time that people talk about Black women is when Black women force people to talk about Black women. And so I'm wondering if like, are the numbers there? Not in the sense that like, obviously, as you said, like Black women are super impacted by HIV, but is there something about like, I guess, like economic background or different things that are preventing them from like kind of like making a big stir about it?
I do. You know, I think it requires that people enter, it takes people who have a little bit of say-so and a little bit of, I hate to say, power to really—
Privilege, yeah.
And privilege, absolutely, to get the wheels turning for certain people. You are 100% correct. So if it's not affecting people with privilege and power, then nobody talks about it, right? Same thing happened with COVID. We knew what was going to happen with COVID because we saw it with HIV. We see it with everything. We knew the communities that were going to be the most highly impacted. We knew who was going to be dying. We knew all of these things. But as soon as it hits the certain communities, then it's like, oh, it's a problem. Same thing with STI, same thing with monkeypox, same thing with everything. If it's killing us, everybody's like, it's fine, Black people. You know, but as soon as it drips on over into the other communities, then it becomes a problem. Now we got to do the thing, you know? And so it is those structural and those social factors that I think keep it hush, right? So if it's killing poor Black women, definitely. So then we start thinking about intersectionality, right? Mm-hmm. So if I'm a queer Black woman who's poor, ain't nobody checking for me at all, right?
Right.
Maybe if I'm a queer Black woman who's got some, you know, I can walk into a room and speak truth to what's going on in my community, maybe somebody will listen. But even then, I've got to have a a little bit more cachet, maybe, because I'm at the intersection of all three of these things. When we talk about, I know we're going to get to my research, that those are some of the things that I research and that I focus on, are things that are more socially impacting people's outcomes. Right. So it's not just, oh, you do drugs. Okay. You know, it's really poverty, unstable housing, it's transportation, it's the environment, it's all of these other things that are, that have an impact on the fact that, yes, I use drugs. You know what I'm saying? And so all of those other things, you know, that have an impact on my behavior. And maybe, you know, it's one thing to say, well, go get tested for stuff. The healthcare center is right across the street. It's right there. And I'm like, you'd be surprised how many people can't get there. It's right there. You're looking right at it, but they can't get there. And it could be when I walk in, the people look at me sideways. When I walk in, the women in the behind the desk are catty. When I walk in, I feel like the stigma, discrimination, then I don't want to go. I just don't want to go. So I'm just, you know, so it's all of those things.
I'm not going to go.
You know, yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a perfect place for us to kind of like launch into syndemics. Like, what exactly does that mean? And then let's get into like some of these kind of syndemics that you look at in your work.
Okay. So thank you very much for bringing in some of my work. So when I look at factors that are associated with STIs, HIV, and I think one thing that we're doing, I want to be very clear too. I was talking to a colleague and we were like, you know what, we need to just start. I mean, my work, you have to focus on something, but I'm starting to understand more too the necessity of just talking about, you know, resilience, you know, healing and wellness, you know, in our community. So a lot of times when, if and when we ever start talking about Black folk, we talk about risk. You're at risk, you know, and we don't focus on things that are, well, let's talk about some of the things that might work, you know, or what has worked, because you live in a community where seemingly a lot of people might have been exposed to HIV or been exposed to these things, but they're thriving. So what are some of those things that we can really focus on that say you're doing okay, you're doing something. So let's play that up and really focus on some of that. So when I think about factors that are associated, and then also thinking about the whole person, right? So for a lot of people, there was a paper written 10 years ago and it was literally called HIV is not my biggest problem. And I was like, that's a good title. You know, it's just like, girl, you're talking about HIV. I'm talking about, I don't have no food in my house. Like I don't have no car. I don't have no food.
Yeah.
And I live in an area where I need a car. Like I don't live in New York City.
Yeah.
Or, you know, where there's like a nice public transportation. Like I can't get to the clinic to get the thing.
Mm-hmm.
So syndemics are, you know, developed in, you know, 1990s, Meryl Singer. But what syndemics proposes, it started with the SAVA syndemic, substance abuse, violence, and HIV. So what it says is that syndemic factors are reciprocally influenced and sustained by larger risk environments and these broader set of power relations that are shaped by gender, race, ethnicity, class, et cetera. So these inextricably linked epidemics, so that's why it's syndemics, they're synergistic epidemics, are reinforced by multiple behavioral, biological, and structural mechanisms. They are not comorbidities. So when we say comorbidities, it's like you have hypertension, depression, and something. You just add them up, the thing. Syndemics, they presume that there's some interaction between biopsychosocial and structural factors, but it's such that the total effect exceeds that of the sum of the effects of the individual syndemic factors. So we're not just adding them up, right? It's the total effect of those that synergy exceeds the sum of the effects of the individual. So we're not just like, oh, depression, poverty, this and that. And you add them up and say, oh, you've got three of these things. It's that they reciprocate one another and they reinforce one another. So not only do they cluster and interact, they are grounded in theory that prioritizes social and structural determinants of health. They focus on both individual and community and population level stuff. So we move beyond the disease status of just the individual, but start to look at these social and structural factors. So they're dynamic, they're synergistic, and they reinforce one another, right? So exposure to those factors are multidimensional, and they result in an excess burden of disease and these outcomes. Syndemics are typically quantitatively assessed. I'm a behavioral epidemiologist and infectious disease epidemiologist. So I look at things quantitatively. What are the numbers? What do they say? And there's some literature now that is kind of juxtaposing syndemics with intersectionality frameworks, which was, you know, introduced by Kimberly Crenshaw, and Lisa Boleg does all of the work in intersectionality, which is more qualitative. So I say syndemics are the, okay, what's going on, and the intersectionality is the why. Why is it that certain segments of the population are more likely to be burdened by these syndemic things? You know, so when we focus on marginalized populations, both syndemics and intersectionality are critical, I think, in understanding systems and experiences of oppression that are associated with poor outcomes. Those intersections of race, class, gender, sexuality, religion, disability, whatever those things are, they intersect, they overlap, but they can also be places of not only oppression, but empowerment for people who live at those intersections, right? So I do more of the what is it? I do the modeling. We do latent class analysis. We might do some structural equation modeling or something. The first paper that I wrote on syndemics in Black men who have sex with men, which is the first paper looking at syndemics with this group of men in 2011, which is feels like 1,000 years ago, I added them up. So I said, if you have two or more of these factors, it's a syndemic. It's asyndemic, and one or less, then it's not. And then we just look at them that way. But now we're able to look and say, what combinations of these things are really, really, really problematic? Because for people, it could be, for you, it's depression, substance use, and poverty. For you, it's racism, this and that, and the other thing, which brings me to something else. And that is how we measure. So when we think about research, it's how do we measure these things? So forever, 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 we were just like, oh, race, it's race. And now we're like, it ain't race, it's racism. And it's not race, it's privilege. It's power, you know, it's all of these things that it's not just race, it's racism. And we think about Black feminism and womanism and, you know, bell hooks called it imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist, patriarchy, all the stuff, everything. What's the word? Put it in there too. All of the above. Check it. You know, it's all of these things. And so we're now just being able to, in public health, really, really look at some of these things. And it's really transdisciplinary, interdisciplinary. We can't do it all in public health. So we need the sociologists, the psychologists, we need the social welfare folks, we need the African, Afro-American studies people, the diasporic people, and we need the folks, the historians, we need the people in communications, the journalists, the people like yourselves. You know, the people to really put the voice out there so that people understand these things.
A holistic effort. Actually, there's a pun there. A holistic effort.
Oh, I love it. Holistic. Exactly.
I like that.
Yeah.
Okay, so as far as what you're finding when you're doing this research, how does the impact of trauma, mental health, and the criminal justice system involvement interact with STD and STI outcomes?
Absolutely. Oh my God. So we have a whole body of literature on this. So what we're finding, a couple of things. So we have a paper that we're trying to write right now. I work with a group of folks at NYU, and it's at the Bard Prison Project, doing some collaboration with folks who are looking specifically at incarceration and its impact on HIV and STI outcomes. I work with a person named Dr. Maria Khan, who is at NYU, and this is the work that we do. So what we're finding is that we did some work where we looked at the impact of what we're calling decarceration. So it's what we call a counterfactual, right? So a counterfactual, it just means it's counter to the fact. So it's as if, you know how you think if people are like, well, if that hadn't happened, then this would have happened, but that's what happened. So that's where we are. So it's looking at if people were not incarcerated, then their risk for HIV and STIs and all of these other raggedy outcomes, and not that HIV and STI is raggedy, but I mean raggedy outcomes like racism and the oppression that they feel because of their sexual orientation and their race, the intersection of that. I want to be very clear about that, that those are some of the things that we're looking at as well with the data called the HIV Prevention Trials Network 061 data. It was the brother study. So we're able to look at they collected these data, but weren't doing much with it, looking at discrimination based on race and discrimination based on sexual orientation and looking at the intersections of those two. Those are the raggedy outcomes that I'm talking about. But we're able to look and see that the impact of, if these brothers were never incarcerated, their risk for HIV and STIs was significantly lower, and exposure to those types of discrimination would have also been significantly lower, right? So now we're looking at the interplay between the criminal injustice system and the things that happen when people are not in jail, right? So it's almost, it's like people, nobody knows necessarily that you were in jail, but those people that are involved in that system have a greater risk as well of being attacked, of being discriminated against. And some of these are by our, you know, law enforcement, right? And so we have questions around that as well. And so we're able to see that if we were to change policy around incarceration and people being involved in that unjust and unjust system of oppression, right? And a way, you know, I was talking about anti-oppressive, excuse me, public health practice, right? And thinking about the ways in which the dominant culture, you know, suppresses, you know, the other cultures. And that could be via, you know, economic development or a lack thereof, redlining, segregation, and all of these things in our communities. And so what we need to do is change the policy around some of these things, right? Because incarceration, slavery, and things of these natures that we know are historically traumatic and have just lasted generations and generations and generations, are ways in which the dominant society enacts power over us. You know, the school to prison pipeline, you know, we were, you know, it bothers me when I say this, but it's really sad, you know, that when I think about the fact that we are destined for greatness, right? That was stifled by certain people so that we would stay, you know, in our place, right? So thinking about some of those things.
Kind of a little bit off me and Rob's script, but just like a personal question, I guess, with how this is showing up in your personal work. Like you're saying some, I agree with what you're saying, but you're saying some like radical things, like it's getting in the like abolish prisons kind of territory.
Yeah.
And I wonder how that manifests in like your work working with other public health officials.
That's what somebody asked me yesterday on the thing. They were like, are you going to lose your job? I was like, I'm tenured, so I don't think I'd lose it. But you know, I think it's up to us. You know, we could, again, I talked to my best friend yesterday and she was on some other stuff. I was like, I can't, but she was talking about these systems of when you're working in a system that is oppressive and how much can you possibly take, you know, before you're just like, ugh. But I said, well, Jen, if I leave or do something else, then who's going to be there to do the thing? You know what I'm saying? I'm like, so we have to change it from within the system. And try not to use systems level behavior, you know, and look at people who have a differing opposing view as being you're wrong, you're this, you're that. No, let's have some discussion about that. What are you talking about? And then again, like creating classes and creating spaces for people to be open about their views and politics. So when I teach my classes, I have to kind of be like, you know, but in my research, I think that we're at a stage now where we really need to push hard and make it okay to talk about some of these radical, you know, we want to talk about Black feminism and we want to talk about womanism and we want to, with a Y, and we want to talk about things that, you know, we want to talk about gender identity. We want to talk about, you know, racial identity and what that means and how it shows up for people, because it doesn't show up the same for everybody. But what does that mean in terms of people's health and the health of the population? And I think that we're at an impasse. We are at a place in society, culturally, where we are dying. We are in a crisis, these events that are that we are being experienced, that are we're experiencing are cataclysmic events. They are massive and cataclysmic events that are going to reverberate for decades, for centuries. We'll be dead. And our kids will be, you know, our you know, people hundreds of years now. They're going to be talking about COVID and what popped off during COVID. They're going to be talking about Black Lives Matter. They're going to be talking about social justice. We weren't talking about social justice a lot, you know, 20 years ago. When I was in grad school, we weren't really talking about social justice. And now, when you talk about social movements, we're talking about things of, you know, I have a student who did her dissertation on social movements. And it was, what was it? I mean, we were using words like getting crunk, and folks were like, what is crunk? And we were like, okay, here we go. Crunk is, you know, whatever. And just, I think it's up to, again, like the next generation to really, really push the envelope and say, this is what we're interested in. And when we talk about public health, it's not just adding up the numbers of people. It's really, really, really looking at some of these social and structural influences on people's health. And it's not as easy as it sounds to make decisions about your health. Oh, you know, you're supposed to eat 5 servings of fruits and vegetables. You know, you didn't put me in a neighborhood that's a food desert and ain't got no food. All I got is Burger King and it's a 4 for $4. And I don't make enough money because you didn't kick me down. And so I'm going to get the 4 for $4. That's what I can afford. That's what my family don't eat. They're going to be full when they go to bed. And so they don't have to wake up hungry or, you know, whatever the thing is. Right. And so it takes all of us. And so I think I'm not that old. So I get to have an impact on my students' ability to say, I'm glad that you're talking about decolonization of public health. I'm glad that you're talking about critical race theory. I'm glad that you're talking about public health, critical race praxis. I'm glad that you're talking about intersectionality, historical trauma theory, and I'm glad you're talking about cultural betrayal trauma theory and all of these theories and things that people aren't really talking about a lot, but anti-oppressive public health practice, what are we going to do? And they get to do that. They get to do that in their dissertations. I'm an epidemiologist, so they got to try to do something quantitatively. It can't be like we did interviews with people, this is what we saw. They could do some mixed methods maybe. But I think now we're at a place where we can do this and we got social media, right? So you can really push the envelope a little bit and say, this is some of the work that I'm doing. This is how you can help. You know, we have HBCUs that are not being tapped. It's amazing. It's crazy. Howard's up the street. I don't know nobody who's working with folks at Howard. You put somebody on or you put somebody on your grant from the community and you really want to put them in there, not just say, oh, we're going to do our research at that community-based organization. No. When you do that and then it doesn't get scored because the people that you put on as co-investigators don't have enough publications. They don't have 5 degrees. They don't have this, that, and the other thing. And then that becomes a problem. So then you put on the same people, you get it funded. You're like, sorry, y'all, you know, kind of thing. So same thing with HBCU. You know, to engage the community takes time. It takes love. It takes massaging. We have a brother named Sakobi Wilson, who's an environmental social justice person. Took him forever, ever, ever. You know, when you're growing up for tenure and they want to look at all your publications and you're like, it took me 5 years to get into the community so they could trust me and understand that I'm one of them and I'm not going to leave. I'm not going to do helicopter research. It takes a long time. You know, so we had to say that needs to be taken into account, you know, when people are going up for tenure. So we have to change it within the institution and do the work.
Right, right. Thank you so much for sharing that. That's like super important.
So we're talking a lot about stigma and discrimination. So how does stigma and discrimination drive risk? And what are some of the ways that stigma shows up regarding STIs and STDs in the Black communities?
Okay. So stigma, I mean, if you ask somebody like what stigma is, sometimes they think it's something that it's not, because it's a really complex phenomenon, right? You know, put forward by Lincoln Phelan, you know, if you're going to go into about the co-occurrence of things. So we have labeling, and I'm going to do a talk on this actually for Health HIV Monday, so I don't want to give away too much. But it's, you know, we have labeling. Yes, darling. You have labeling, stereotyping, separation, status loss, and discrimination. It's typically based on multiple different aspects of an individual's actual or perceived identity or group membership. We know that it's detrimental for people's health. We have HIV-related stigma. We got racism and homophobia. So with respect to labeling, it applies to social exclusion and rejection. Labeling theory explains how others perceive a person's behavior. Then based on those characteristics, they label it within the social or cultural conventions, right? So it's labeled as you're deviating from what the norm is, right? Stereotyping describes negative behaviors in society that are directed towards specific groups of people. So especially if we're going to talk about LGBTQIA2S plus folks, right? Then you're stereotyped, right? In many ways. So I think about intersectional stigma as well. So intersectional stigma is stigma along the lines of your multiple identity. So intersectionality comes back in again. Mm-hmm. It could be stigma around your condition. So again, you've got HIV, you've got an STI, you've got something, you got monkeypox, right? So it's outward facing. So maybe people can see it. And then you've got stigma that is either internalized, enacted, or anticipated, right? So it's enacted. I actually walked into the clinic and they didn't help me, or, you know, whatever the thing is. It's anticipated. I know when I go to the clinic, that's what's going to happen. And then it's internalized. I don't deserve to be helped because I'm a Black queer woman who has HIV or the thing, you know what I'm saying? And so then you start to, it's very closely related to discrimination and being discriminated against. And it's closely related as well to minority stress theory and minority stress as well, where there's a link between stigma and mental health for, you know, gay, bisexual folks. And it's excess stress to which an individual forms, that's formed from socially stigmatized positions. And it can be either unique, you know, chronic or socially based. Some of the processes are like internalized homophobia, anticipated stigma, and things of those natures, and internalize everything, internalized stigma, internalized racism. You got folks out here. I mean, it's amazing, right? Like a Black gay man who's just like, oh, I don't do other Black gay people. It's like, what? No, they're not educated. They're not this, they're not that. And it's like, okay, you got some internal things going on here, brother. You know, so I want to talk to you about PrEP. And then they don't want to talk about PrEP because they're only dealing with white men. It's like, oh, okay. So you good. Okay.
So is the stigma there that they don't want to talk about PrEP because white gay men are like less likely to be positive?
They're less likely. They're less likely. And there's somehow better than, you know, so they are less likely and they're not, you know.
Like, oh, they don't got that.
They don't have that. We see that with heterosexual folks as well. You know what I mean? Like I've chosen to date outside of my race because they are less likely to whatever. And we know that that's just simply not true. So a lot of that is, like, we know your internalized sense of self, right? Your own internal self-esteem. Like, so what do you think about other Black people? What do you think about yourself if you think that that other Black gay people are less than you? But then what does that say? And a lot of times that has to do with disclosure and stigma around sexual orientation and all these other things. So maybe if I look like I'm going to dinner with this person, this other race person, people won't know, you know, necessarily that I'm gay, or, you know, there's a whole lot going on, right? So when you think about stigma, and then that feeds into the rates of STIs that we see in our community, right? So if you go and do that over there, then you will go out with other people in your racial group, but you won't date them. You won't be in a relationship with them. Then you could potentially be transmitting STIs to those people because you don't think the other people are going to get it. And they might have it. And so you're not using all of the tools that you have in your toolbox to actually prevent yourself from contracting something so that you don't transmit it to other people in your community, right? And so stigma is deep. You know, so we've got, you know, we did a study on internalized stigma among older Black women living with HIV in Prince George's County. You know, and some of these systems were, you know, really, when you start the starting of the interview, it was, well, I was a good girl, you know, and I was like, okay, let's unpack this a little bit. You know, what does that mean? You know, and it's the stigma around HIV. So what that basically means is that HIV is bad and you were a good girl and these things don't happen to good girls. You did all of the things that you were supposed to do, right? You went to so-and-so university, you went to college, right? You the thing, you know, this is why we've got a lot of women, you know, they contract HIV and they're married and they're just like, whoa, I was a good girl. I got married. I did these things, you know, and it's not that, it's the environment and the community and the structures within which we have to function. That is the issue, you know, and, you know, you know, we had people who were like, you know, we wrote a paper on this as well. I knew that I had HIV and I had, you know, I had a husband and who died. And on his deathbed, he was like, I don't know what you're talking about. She was like, so let's talk about this again. I have HIV. You must have HIV. So we should try to take medication so that we, you know, so that we're here for our kids and our grandkids and stuff. And he was like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Whoa.
Right. And so all of those things. But that started in the 80s when it was brought out that it was gay related. And then that just turned the tides of everything. And what a lot of people don't know is that there were Black men who were dying of HIV, who were dying of AIDS at the time, and nobody reported them. So that first MMWR report that was written, that had the three white men, two in New York, two in LA, one in New York. Brothers was dying in the hospital and nobody was checking on them. Nobody was trying to figure out what's going on with them. We were dying early and nobody said nothing. Nobody was like, well, what about the Black man over there who has cancerous lesions on his skin and he's only 24? Nobody said anything about the fact that they were Black people. Just like nobody said anything about the fact that Jeffrey Dahmer was eating Black people. Nobody said that ever. Everybody just thought he was killing people. Come to find out, he was racist and he was taking out Black gay men, period, point blank. Yeah. So anyway, I'm getting off, you know, that's too, now I'm getting too real. I mean,
it all connects though. Yeah, I got goosebumps.
All of it. It's all connecting. The stigma, the stuff.
Can we kind of do it? Because I know that the early data on this is limited because it's like in progress and just happening, but I'd like to use this as like a kind of launch pad to talk about monkeypox a little bit. So like early limited data had suggested that Black and Hispanic populations were both disproportionately affected by monkeypox outbreaks. And this is something that was spreading primarily in MSM communities. So they were disproportionately affected by monkeypox outbreaks and also receiving less shares of the vaccine. Can you speak a little bit on that?
Oh, Lord. It's like everything. Right? So, it's too much. You know, it's like everything else. Like I said earlier, this is how we come from full circle. Mm-hmm. Until if it's killing other folks, they're going to roll out all the vaccines. You know, you can go to Canada. You can go to the grocery store and get the vaccine. You know,
for
like
monkeypox?
That.
I mean, not the grocery.
Yes, not the grocery store. But you can go to any place and get the, they are just handing out like candy. And here, this is why it's so sociopolitical. It's like, so why can't, I don't even know where to go get the vaccine. I'm an epidemiologist. I don't know where the vaccine at. And what we know now is that the majority of hospitalized monkeypox patients also have HIV. So then we get that thing, right? So they're comorbid. They're untreated folks hit hardest. It's just like the HIV thing. Why do we do this? The day you realize that, it looks like the people who are coming in have HIV. What you can't say is that the people are gay and bisexual. Why'd you do this? It re-stigmatized something that didn't need to be stigmatized in the first place. Because you don't have to be gay and bisexual to get monkeypox. We know this. It's about proximity. It's a skin lesion. It's skin to skin. It's a virus, right? But it's also spread through close contact. So there was a thing, and I can't remember which one it was, but it was very similar. I think it might be Zika, but I might be lying. But I'm gonna lie right now on public.
Okay. I can always go back in the edit and say what you meant.
Similarly. So what people didn't know was that two gay men actually transmitted this virus between themselves. And nobody said anything about that, right? They didn't want to call it sexually transmitted, but it was transmitted via sex, right? And so I think
I think it is Zika, because I see homosexual and Zika virus infection published 2018.
Yeah, then that is it. It was Zika.
In NIH. Yeah.
It's Zika. And so, but nobody, you know, it was like the one case where they were like afraid to say that it was sexually transmitted. So I think that there's a balance. So you don't want to not say that something is transmitted the way that it's transmitted, but you don't want to then tack on a certain segment of the population, and then that becomes stigmatizing. So then, you know, because now that they said it's a gay thing, so then you got brothers out here who's like, oh, you got the monkeypox virus? Oh, you got the monkeypox vaccine? Mm-hmm.
It's like having a septum piercing. It's like, that's a signifier for being gay.
Identifier.
Yeah, it's an identifier. It's blue hair.
It's an identifier. Right. It's like, oh, you know what I'm saying? And so you don't want to do that. I forgot your question.
Just your thoughts on monkeypox and like the fact that it was disproportionately affecting Black and Hispanic, I think it was male specifically. And then also the fact that they were less likely to get the vaccine.
I think that goes along with stigma. Everything. Like first of all, we have to talk about susceptibility. I don't want to get into stages of change or health belief model when we think about behavior change models. But in order to get people to go do something, they have to feel like they're susceptible. Like, nobody's going to get a vaccine if they just feel like, I ain't going to get monkeypox. So who cares? At the same time, you don't want to scare the bejeebus out of people. Like, you're going to get it. And here's what we can't do. You're going to get it because you're Black. I had somebody, a nurse, say that to somebody about HIV, a Black woman. You're at higher risk because you're Black. I was like, please tell me you didn't tell that person that. How do you have a job? You know, I was like, she's not more susceptible because she's Black. That makes no sense whatsoever. Right? Talk about other things. Talk about, again, the environment, the community, et cetera, right? So it's not because you're Black. When we see higher rates of things in certain community, that is cause for alarm. But there's typically another factor that's at play. There's usually something else that's going on. So that goes back to, you can't just say, oh, it's because I'm Black. It's the fact that you are in an environment potentially where it's densely populated. Maybe your behaviors might put you at greater risk. I just think about those kinds of things, right? Because it's not going to jump. You know, COVID scared everybody because you didn't have to do much to get it. You know, it's expelled through aerosols. You know, when you cough, when you sneeze, when you talk, come to find out. Remember, they were like, somebody got at the baseball game when nobody coughed and they were just cheering for teams. And so then everybody was like, oh no, right? So as long as it's affecting certain segments of the population and it's something that they need to do to get it, then there's other segments of the population who they're just not going to worry about it, but they need to be worried about it. We are getting a re-emergence of infectious diseases that we thought that have been eradicated, right? So we have to look at why that is. And I teach this in class. So, you know, globalization. So the more we're able to travel and do all these things, and is, you know, people want to get political about it. I don't really step into that lane about biological and political warfare and all of these things, but fact of the matter is, they're here. And so we need to do whatever we can as a community, as a population, to reduce and to you know, sort of eradicate it. You know, even monkeypox, you know, it's a specific pathogen for which, you know, we haven't been worried about forever, right? And so now it's all of a sudden back, you know, and again, there's always some level of something all the time, right? And so then what happens is things become endemic. So with coronavirus, the COVID is never going anywhere. It's always going to be here. There's always going to be some baseline level of people who have it. A certain segment of the population is always going to have it. It's like flu. And then we'll go through these cyclical trends where it's just like, you know, it's COVID season again, you know, whatever, where it's like, get your thing, wear your mask, put on your gloves or whatever the thing is. And what it reminds us is how susceptible we are as a population, as a community. Because remember when COVID first popped off and all the toilet paper was gone? and all the lotion and all the paper towel. Mm-hmm. Everybody was
Lysol,
like,
yeah.
And the Lysol and soap. And everybody's like, what have you been washing your hands with? You know what I mean? Like, why is it all gone now? You know what I mean? It's like, so these are things that we should be doing. You should be covering your mouth when you sneeze. You should be washing your hands when you something before you do the food. And, you know, these are things. And what it showed was, I don't care what people say about masks don't work. Yes, they do. Because we saw a decrease in the number of flu cases over the past 2 years because people were wearing masks, right? And so there are things that we can do to reduce the risk, you know, but there are things that that, you know, politicians, legislation, you know, there are things that people need to do who are kind of the higher ups, you know, to see to it as public health professionals, people who work at the CDC, the health department, et cetera, to see to it that, and researchers like myself, to see to it that we don't place undue stress and blame. That's what ends up happening. You know, blaming people for things, you know, it's, we need to look as a society and say, why is it that we see greater numbers of Black folks and Hispanic people presenting with monkeypox? Why? It's not the who, it's really the why. Why is that? But what that requires is that we take steps back. And what ends up happening is we end up pointing to the same things that we've been talking about on this podcast. And that requires that we undo a lot of what has been done in this country to maintain the status quo. And that's the hard part. You know, we talk about oppression, like what are we gonna do? Like, it's okay, now we know it's racism. Ooh, okay, good.
What are we gonna do?
You know, you have to, the intervention's not with me, it's with the racist. You know what I mean? Like, the intervention's not with me. The intervention is, what are you going to do? How are you gonna train the next generation of public health professionals and clinicians, doctors? How are we gonna train the lawyers? How are we gonna train the people to understand that they come into the space with bias? How do you check that bias? How do you train people in being culturally humble and cultural humility and all of these things that we know are necessary so that people can treat people with the respect and with the dignity that we deserve so that we can be healthy and then we can be happy? All we want to do is be happy. That's everybody. All we want to do is be happy and be healthy. That's it. Yeah.
You have spoken a word in this past hour. Listen, that we've had. You know, I am so grateful. Is there anything else that you would like to leave us with before we wrap up?
I would like to leave us with, we need to widen the lens, I think, of social justice, right? If we're going to mitigate public health crises, these are the things that we're talking about. If we are going to have an impact on health equity, so not equality, where it's okay, everybody gonna get the green pill. No, it's like, no, you're little, so the little people get the green pill. You're about an average height, you're gonna get the blue pill, the tall people gonna get the red pill. Now you all can see the thing, right? And so how do we really have an impact on equity in health? Reproductive justice. Like, we are in a place now where it's just raggedy, right? And so I can make a decision about having a baby, not having a baby. And if I do, how do I parent in a healthy way and in a healthy environment? And what are we going to do about, you know, Black maternal mortality? Like, we are dying and everybody's like, okie dokie. No, I'm tired. I'm sick. I'm tired. Right. And so we need to widen the lens of social justice. What are we going to do? And it takes all of us working together, because Black folks' health is the health of everybody. You know, let's keep it real. So movements such as anti-racism, decolonization, disability rights, LGBTQIA2+ rights, climate justice, all of these things need to work alongside movements for what I will say for gender equity, right? Because we talk about intersectionality, developing partnerships and coalitions so we learn from one another. How do we share resources and platforms so that we all advance our respective agendas, which the overall agenda is health, resilience, wellness, and happiness, and healing. How do we heal?
Holistically.
Holistically.
Holistic.
I love it. Y'all too.
Thank you so much for being here with us, TP.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. This was fantastic.
You're fantastic.
Oh, you're so wonderful. Thank you so much.
I've learned so much.
This is great. This has made my day. It's like the first thing I did this morning. I was like, I ain't doing nothing else. I need to get my thing together. And this has made my day.